comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. Welcome to another evening of exciting discussion and discovery of information you won't find just anywhere else. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. If you're not getting it, it's because you haven't subscribed. So go over to my website and click the link that says K-Files, all right, and subscribe. And then use that link you'll get in the email. You'll get an email that has a link in it. Use that and activate your subscription, and that way you will start getting the K-Files. Saturday night, this coming Saturday night, is the time for our monthly chat. The first Saturday of every month, I go into the chat room and hang out for a couple of hours. So join us. You'll have a good time. I guarantee you'll have a good time. All right? So just join us in the chat room and hang out for a couple of hours, and we'll just see what pops up to talk about. Now, as you know, I don't get into conspiracy theories outside of the UFO paranormal genre, as a general rule. Now, since the tragic events that took place on September the 11th, 2001, we refer to that as 9-1-1 or 9-11, since those tragic events, I have had many requests to do shows about 9-11, about the truth of what really happened on 9-11. And I've only done one. That was with Dr. Judy Wood. Well, tonight, I will be talking with Robert Kelder. He's the publisher of a book called 9-11, The Accusation. Originally published in the Netherlands, it has now been translated into English. And the reason that I'm going to do a show on this, actually there are two reasons. One is that this book does represent a new entry into this debate about the truth of the events of what took place on September the 11th, 2001. So it's a new slant on it. And secondly, this author is a highly controversial figure. He lives in Amsterdam, and he claims to be a former spy and assassin for the Serbian UDB. That's their version of the KGB. So we're going to be talking with the publisher. Now, there's a reason we're talking with the publisher and not the author. The author does not speak English. I have been in communication with the author via email that I sent, written in Serbian, but he doesn't speak English, and so for English-speaking audiences, the publisher represents him and speaks about what's in the book. And so we'll be talking with the publisher, who is here in the USA right now. Robert Kelder is promoting the book and other books published by his company, the company being in the Netherlands. All right, we'll be back with Robert Kelder right up after this message. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, we're going to be talking with Robert Kelder, who is the publisher for this book written by Slobodan Mitrić. So for all of our Serbian-speaking audience this evening, dobro veče, kako ste? And we are glad you are here. However, Robert Kelder is not a Serbian speaker. He is from the Netherlands. Robert, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on your show, man.
Okay, now Robert, let's jump right into this. You live in the Netherlands. Slobodan Mitrić has written this book called 9/11: The Accusation, and you are here in the USA representing the book and promoting the book. You were at the Jacob Javits Center for the big book expo that was there.
Right.
And you had a pretty interesting thing that happened where you got to present this book to someone very well known to everyone around the world. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I saw in the Daily Show, the Daily newspaper that they put out, that among the notable, so to speak, that was doing autograph sessions, there was Michael Moore, you know, the filmmaker. 9/11, Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
So on the second day, May 25th, I lined up in the big line of about 100 people or more, waiting to get a glimpse of the great man. And when it was my turn, I suddenly produced him with, or confronted him with, or presented him this book, 9/11, The Accusation, which has a subtitle, Bringing the Guilty to Justice. And he took it in his hand, he looked at it, and then the professional photographer snapped a photo, Polaroid or whatever, and within minutes I was... I was on the photo with Michael Moore holding the book in his hand. So that was a little an attempt to beat him at his own game, so to speak. You know. But he hasn't responded since. I also gave a book to his publisher, a woman, and sent him an email on his website asking him if he has any thoughts on his book. But I'm still waiting to hear from him.
I see. Okay, look, I want to jump right in now and get to what this book is about. And let me preface it with a brief statement. I've already said to the audience that everybody knows that I don't get into conspiracy theories, and I don't promote them, and I don't attack them, because that's just not what this show is about. But there are a couple of reasons why I am stepping across the line tonight. One reason is because this book does represent a new slant on what really took place on 9/11. Well, that's not hard to come by. Here in the United States of America, there's a new slant on everything every day. But because of who the author is, that new slant deserves to be considered, and we need to take a look at it. Now, we'll get into who the author is in just a moment, but give us a thumbnail of this book. What's the point of this book? What is it that, when we get it and we read it, what's the point being made by this book?
Okay. Well, and you mentioned this term conspiracy theory, right?
Yeah.
And when people say this book is about conspiracy theory, I say, wait a second. It's not conspiracy theory, this book. It's conspiracy practice.
Okay.
It's not an intellectual, speculative theory the upteens slant on what might have happened. No. It is, in a sense, practice, and he describes what actually happened from the viewpoint of a counterintelligence operative who, with his team, and I say claims, but of course he not only claims, but he says he did this. He claimed to have infiltrated the gang that was ultimately responsible for this 9/11 tragedy, but it had a lot of trial runs, so to speak, and one of them being Lockerbie. And that is the overall, so to speak, bottom line as far as the approach is concerned. You know, without getting into the details.
All right. So now he claims that he and his team infiltrated the gang of people involved in producing both the Lockerbie tragedy and what happened on 9/11, right?
Right.
All right. Yeah. So let's talk about who he is and his team. His name is Slobodan Mitrić. He is formerly attached to the Vojska Yugoslavia, that's the Yugoslavian army.
He was not attached he started a magazine called the Serbian Army.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood then.
Yeah.
Okay, so he was not attached to Yugoslavia.
Neither was he really attached to UDBA in the normal sense of the word. He was a very close attaché, confidant of Marshal Tito, you know.
Okay.
The leader of Yugoslavia, and at that time, I think also the so-called third neutral nations, you know, the 100 or so neutral nations that he headed, and he was involved not in as a secret agent, but he was involved in counterintelligence. He was checking the security of the secret agents. So he was very high up in the echelon of the command, so to speak, until he defected in 1972.
Why did he defect?
Well, he was ordered by his superiors to liquidate a opponent of Tito at that time, and this was a man called Vladimir Dubčević, who was a theoretician, a Marxist Leninist theoretician, and promoting a different line than Tito.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Slobodan refused to carry out this order, met Dubčević, interrogated him, got to know everything that he wanted, and then let him go. Now, if you do something like that, that means a certain death. And this is what happened then. He fled to Amsterdam in 1973, December 1973. At Christmas time, in the center of Amsterdam, there was an attempt made on his life by five thugs who were hired by the UDBA to assassinate him. They shot at him 17 bullets with a Thompson submachine gun. By a miracle, he survived, and in the ensuing shootout, five of these guys were hurt. Three of them, I think, were actually killed. This was created a big spur, as you might imagine, on Christmas Eve in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm. And he was arrested for that, wasn't he?
Sorry?
He was arrested for that, wasn't he?
He was arrested, and at first they claimed it was a an underworld reckoning within the Yugoslav underworld, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Only 3 years afterwards, it was recognized that it was a political crime. But in spite of many promises that they made to him, that he would, get a facial operation, and that he would be employed as a spy, etc. They made all kinds of promises.
Who made those promises?
Sorry?
Who made those promises?
The Secret Service, the BVD, which is the equivalent of the internal Secret Service, the Binnenlandsveiligheidsdienst.
Yeah, the UDB. Whenever this show began, it began in Kosovo. And at that time, my office was in the building that formerly had been the headquarters of the UDB in Kosovo.
Yeah. And what year was that?
2000, when the show began. I first arrived in Kosovo in 1999. But
you know these situations there. But I'm talking.
Yeah, and I know some of these UDB agents. Yeah. I've met some of them. And I'll tell you, they're serious as a heart attack.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. As a matter of fact, Slobodan, you mentioned Kosovo. He wrote a play in 1987 called The Battle of Kosovo. No, it was in 1989. You know, when the 1600th anniversary, because it was 1389 that the Battle of Kosovo took place. I think, right, on the Amselfeld.
Yeah, 13 something. I can't remember. 13. Yeah.
So in 1989, he wrote in 2 weeks in a heavily sort of revelation. He wrote a wonderful play, which I recently translated into English, available on the internet. It had never been performed yet. This guy is not only a counterintelligence agent with a photographic memory as far as sight and sound is concerned. In fact, he remembers every word I spoke about 20 years ago. It's amazing.
And that answers one of the questions I was going to ask you. Do you know him personally?
Oh yeah, of course. I met him back in 1987. When, as a matter of fact, he had been sent out to investigate me, because I was there was suspicion that I was a rough terrorist. I was living on a terrain behind the zoo in a beat up wagon, which indeed had been a meeting place for terrorists and criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sent by his superiors, by his friends. Some of them were very high up Dutch resistance fighters, you know, the famous one being a Soldier of Orange. And names your listeners probably don't know, but the Dutch might know them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, he describes all this in one of his previous novels, A Golden Tip, on the entanglement of the upper and underworld and the murder of Gerrit Jan Heijn, a famous rich Dutch industrialist. He describes how he got on this terrain, how he investigated me, and then cleared me of all suspicions, and we became friends. And from that time onwards, 1987, I've known him off and on. I knew his wife, Iris de Vries, a Dutch artist. And already then he was talking about this novel Operation Twins he had written in 1982. Because after he defected to the West, he got connected with a very important American political and military figures such as Philip Crane and others. Philip Crane at that time was investigating the CIA for criminal elements in there, and Slobodan was going to help him with that. And in fact, he then also handed personally to Philip Crane on one of his visits to the American Embassy in The Hague copies of this magazine that I mentioned, the Serbian Army. It's a trilingual magazine in Serbian, French, and English, in which he then publicized these 9/11 forewarnings. You know, that's his, in a sense, is one of his main claims to fame in this context, because not only did he forewarn the 9/11 in this book, Operation Twins, from 1982. Afterwards, he showed photographs of nose-diving planes on targets in Washington, New York, but also in Frankfurt, in The Hague. There were many more targets than were actually targeted. And that is why he justifies the calling, the naming of the book, 9/11, The Accusation, because he accuses the people that he sent these forewarnings to, like Bush Senior and Junior, Clinton, the leaders of the FBI, the CIA, and also other leaders of the free world and monarchs, that they didn't heed his warnings. Let the 9/11 attacks happen, and then shifting the blame to a party that actually had nothing to do with it. that's in a nutshell the overall view of the book without getting into the operational details.
Does he name names in this book?
Yeah, he names names. He names his, not of the perpetrators, but one of his assistants. The figure you see on these photographs that are all in the appendices of the book. You know, the book 9/11 is one half a novel, a true crime atomic contra espionage novel. The other half are all appendices, including these five or six forewarnings showing these planes nose diving on these buildings, targeted buildings. And on the ground, you see groups of terrorists detonating explosives which had been planted in the buildings beforehand. Exactly what happened at 9/11. But you have to add one important detail, and that is, for example, his answer to those people that say, how could those planes, you know, cause such great damage, because the building, 9/11 building, the Twin Towers, were designed to withstand attacks by airplanes. He shows in his chapter called Fateful Flights that in the noses of these planes there were nuclear material hidden. In fact, these planes were like nuclear projectiles, you know, the same kind of uranium that's put in shells to detonate and penetrate tanks.
Okay, so what he's saying then is, what he's saying is that there was not just a terrorist attack on 9/11. There was a nuclear attack.
There was an overall attack on important targets, including Frankfurt, London, even The Hague, and he said that this was actually all planned to happen at the end of the second millennium, on the 31st of December, and that actually was the reason for grounding all these airplanes on that day. You know, the pretext was Y2K, you know, computer problems or this, not the other.
Mm-hmm.
No, he says this was actually the reason. By grounding all these planes, they prevented 9/11, so to speak, on that date from happening. And then he said it was postponed to September 11th.
Why? Okay, why did they postpone it? Well, we have a break taking over. We'll get the answer to that when we come back. We will be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Robert Kelder. And when we went away for break, I had just asked the question. Robert, you had told us that the original attack that eventually took place on 9/11 was originally scheduled for December the 31st. I guess that would be December the 31st, 2000.
I mentioned that he wrote this book. This is actually a trilogy called Operation Twins, right?
Yeah.
And that with some other achievements won him a honorary doctorate in law from a Arizona College of Police Science. And in fact, in 1986, he wanted to make a movie of this with the backing of Reagan. They had some very important, well-known stars lined up, like Sophia Loren, Paul Newman, you name them. And then in 1999, the movie didn't go on because the CIA confiscated the manuscript, but he managed to salvage the first part, and he then republished it in 1999, and this may have been a reason why it was postponed. But he couldn't postpone or he couldn't prevent the ultimate disaster attack on September 11th. For reasons that I don't know, he certainly sent out warnings. I mentioned these four warnings. I mentioned also, you asked me about names. One of his assistant directors that infiltrated this gang was shown on all these photographs, and that is Nikola Kavaja, a legend in Serbia, who was, as a matter of fact, a former bodyguard of President Kennedy. But as far as the perpetrators are concerned, he names, there's a figure that looms in all the chapters, of all the 13 chapters. And this is, I mean, you wrote in, on your text that an inside job done by rich, powerful man. Now, this man is extremely rich. He was once arrested in Paris for embezzling $100 million. He is a corrupt head of the Dutch Secret Service. He has a huge villa in the center of The Hague. He is involved in a very corrupt and very vicious pedophile group. He has sent various people to jail for things they haven't done, among others a serial killer named Koos Hertogs.
Let me ask you something about that.
Yeah.
Here you are talking about this guy, and he's powerful, and you're saying he's corrupt, and, you know, you've given his name, and you've said
the point I'm trying to make. Slobodan hasn't mentioned his name yet. He hasn't dared divulge it because he's not able to protect himself.
Yeah, but you did.
I mentioned Nikola Kavaja, but that was not the name of this rich, powerful man. That was one of his companions. The only name that Slobodan mentions with respect to this chief perpetrator is a nickname, an alias, and he calls him the Hague Mouse. The Hague Mouse. This is another important point about the book. We call it an advanced edition. It's the first part of a complete disclosure in which, for example, he shows how people were hidden in a box in the baggage department of the Twin Towers flights and got out of the box, put on gas masks, led sleeping gas into the cabin and the cockpits. Then broke into the cockpit in the cabin, blew up the door to the cockpit. Everyone had fallen immediately asleep. Attached a computer, a mini computer, to the steering system of the Boeings, which were then guided by transmitters planted in the offices where they were designed to hit, and so to speak, were then led by these transmitters that sent out signals. The computer picked them up, and that's how they were smashed into the office buildings, with, as I said, the nuclear material hidden in the nose. That is the kind of operational description of what happened to these flights.
Okay, now I have a very important question here.
Yeah.
How would a Serbian counterintelligence officer have all of this inside information on something going on inside the United States?
Yeah. Well, as I said, he became very much in favor with. Okay, it's not for nothing that when in 1986 there was an airplane waiting to take him to deport him to Serbia or to Yugoslavia, right? Then 43 American senators and congressmen, headed by Philip Crane, sent a telegram to his lawyer, Corvinus, threatening to break diplomatic relations with Holland if Slobodan were to be deported to a certain death. So he had made an incredible impression on these people, on his universal, worldwide knowledge as a criminologist, as an inside figure into the deepest echelons of the criminal world. And because of also not only Philip Crane, but I mentioned this U.S. General Healy, Raymond Healy, an Irish American, who, as a matter of fact, became his foster father. They spent some time together in Munich and in Paris. And Healy was you didn't find anything on the internet, but that doesn't mean he didn't exist. Healy was a former director for the CIA for Europe and Asia. And don't forget, Slobodan is now, he was appointed that in 1992, world director of Reserve Police International, which is a universal police agency, which was, it is true, disbanded in the States, but again, founded anew by him, he said, in a West European country, I believe, the Netherlands. But I refer to the appendices in the book, the people who are disbelieving this. In fact, all these things I'm saying are quite amazing, and they have to be backed up by these documents.
In fairness, now I have to say that yes, they are in the appendices. There's documentation in the appendices. But when I checked on the documentation, some of it I couldn't verify. For instance, plus there's some personal knowledge. You know, I was international police. I was, you know, for real. And worked for the international police, which is under the United States Department of State. And did everything from foot patrol all the way up to a commander level, and did a bunch of missions. And I never heard of this police organization, this Reserve Police International. I had never heard of it. So I did some checking on it, and what I discovered is that it was founded by a Raymond Healy in 1982,
right.
He at that time listed his address in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
And then each year, a corporation in Arizona is required to file an annual report, and each year they filed an annual report until 1993. So 10 years after it was founded, on that 10th year, they failed to file an annual report.
Yeah.
On March 1994, their status as a corporation was revoked because they had failed to file this annual report.
Yeah.
The college, the Arizona College of Police Science, I lived in Arizona.
Yeah.
And when I came back from overseas, I happened to live in the Phoenix area, and I had never heard of this college. And by the way, I was doing training for security guard companies and for campus police forces, and so I would go onto the campus and train them, and I had never heard of this college. So I checked on that. There's no record of it having ever existed. But there is in Slobodan Mitrić's documentation in the appendices a picture of his certificate from this college. And one of the names signed to it is Raymond Healy, who is also the founder of Reserve Police International in Tucson, which went out of business in 1994. Another problem that I ran into with Raymond Healy is I can find, up until showtime, and I'll tell you, I was on the phone with someone doing background on this right up until 22 minutes before the show.
Okay,
and this is someone on the inside who can check things very, very quickly. And right up until that point, we had not found a General Raymond Healy ever listed with the United States military. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't exist. Now, having said all of that, let me say this for the audience. I ran a unit in Kosovo that you will never find documentation of ever having existed. But I did do it, and I did it for about 2 years. And there are people that served with me and that were under my command in that unit that could testify to that. But you will never find documentation that that unit existed.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
So...
You have to leave it open.
Yeah, I have to say... To be fair to the audience, I have to say I cannot find any record of a General Raymond J. Healy.
Listen,
but that doesn't mean he did not exist.
No. That's the logical. That's the proper logical conclusion. You cannot make a deduce from that he didn't exist. In fact, there are many photos of that. There are many photos of this man in the links that I send you. I send you. And in fact, in the appendices, there are these forewarnings, these photos, and every time there's a link on the actual Serbian army magazines that they were published in, there's about 10 or so links, mm-hmm. and these magazines are there are more than 100, 400 pages, and you find in them letters from Healy to Slobodan, also to Slobodan's American connection, a Serb named Markovic, mm-hmm. who disappeared under very mysterious circumstances. So in my mind, having known Slobodan for more than 20 years and having seen all these documents, having printed photocopied one of these Serbian armies myself in the house of one of the characters out of the book, who is called a computer programmer, who plays a very, very evil, in a sense, double-dealing role. I have no reason to believe that this General Healy didn't exist.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll pick up right there when we come back with Robert Kelder. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and to my guest this evening, Robert Kelder. He is the publisher for this book. The book is called 9/11, The Accusation, and it's written by Slobodan Mitric, residing in Amsterdam. And Mitric says that he was... counterintelligence for UDBA, UDB, and in, by the way, at least in Kosovo, they simply referred, the people simply referred to this organization as DB, DB.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The first time I heard someone say that, I was with a friend, a Serbian friend, and we were walking down the street. I saw someone that I had never seen in this little village before, and I asked my friend, who is that? And he said, Debe.
Okay.
And I thought he said, Debbie. I said, Debbie? He said, Da, Debe. It took me a while to understand he meant Udebe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But that's what they called them. All right, now look, let me ask you a question. Would you say... You know Slobodan Mitric. Would you say that he is a Serb nationalist, or would you say that he is a patriot?
He is a universal soul. He is not a narrow nationalist. I would rather say he's a patriot. He's concerned with the welfare of all mankind, and in his job as general director of Reserve Police International, he fights injustice everywhere, wherever this may be.
You know, all right, he's 62 years old now, right?
Right, he's quite ill. Mm-hmm. Hasn't gone out of his house since last June. We have to bring food to him. And he still hopes to write the definite full disclosure of this book.
Okay, well, before we go forward with that, let me ask a question. On his web pages, there is a picture of him, which I have up on our TV channel.
Yeah, I see it here in front of me.
Okay, this picture has him in the uniform of Vojska Yugoslavia.
Right.
I know for sure that is a Vojska Yugoslavia uniform because I once possessed one of those uniforms. It came into my possession, including the hat and the insignia badge that goes on the hat, of that. So if he was not in Vojska Yugoslavia, what's he doing wearing this uniform?
That was some time ago. I think he has also a uniform of a general, but he wanted to just wear the general. I think it's a uniform of a simple soldier.
Uh-huh.
You know.
What's the purpose behind him wearing the uniform if he's not actually part of the Yugoslav army there?
I don't know. Maybe he put it on for some kind of special purpose. That I don't know. You'd have to ask him that himself.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to make contact with him via email. He answers email usually, and especially in Serbian.
Mm-hmm.
That I could ask him. You could ask him. I don't think it's a essential point in this whole story.
Well, it is an essential point. If going to his credibility, if he's trying to portray himself as being Yugoslav Army when he was not, if this is just for a promotional purpose, then...
Because he edited this magazine, the Serbian Army. I think it was in that connection that he posed as a Serbian soldier.
Okay.
I think it's probably in that context, you know?
Okay, so... he began his association with the UDB when Joseph Broz Tito was the ruler of Yugoslavia.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an interesting thing about Mr. Tito. Tito was really unclassifiable. And here's why I say that. Here in the United States, they always talked about him as a communist leader. All right. In Moscow, they said, no, he's not a communist. Over here, they were saying, yeah, he is a communist.
Yeah.
So he was getting money from both sides, hoping to win him their directions. And he finally was kicked out of the Socialist International. They kicked him out because they said, man, you're a capitalist and you're not even a socialist anymore. All right. But also an interesting thing about him, he ruled a nation made of six republics and, two autonomous regions.
Right.
Vojvodina being one of them.
Yep.
So, when you go into these areas, I mean, you get into an area that's predominantly Muslim. Okay, well, even today, when you go in their homes, most of them have a picture of Tito somewhere hanging on the wall. And you ask them, Did you like Tito? Oh, he was wonderful. Life was better. So then you go to a Serb home, and they've got a picture of Tito. You go to an Albanian home, picture of Tito. You go to a Bosnian home, picture of Tito. You go to a Macedonian, Montenegrin, Slovenian home. They have pictures of Tito. They love Tito.
Slobodan is actually more a follower of Mihailovic, you know, the opponent of Tito in the resistance.
Yeah.
And he is more leaning also to a monarchist view. He knows the present king of King Alexander.
Yes.
He also knew the crown prince who was, in fact, imprisoned on an island, I think in Belgrade. In fact, he learned to paint icons from this this crown prince.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I said also to you, he's a very high birth. His cousin is Boris Tadic, the president of Serbia. You know, and his lineage goes back to kings and nobles.
Okay, so he's friends with the king, or the guy who would be king if there was a monarchy. He's the heir to the throne, and so he's friends with him. He's cousins with the president, Tadic. Why is he afraid to go to Serbia?
Oh, because when he defected, he gave. Well, in fact, the two reasons. I told you the first reason, that he committed high treason by not carrying out the order to liquidate Dubčević, you know?
Okay.
Vladimir Dubčević. Secondly, when he defected, he gave the names of about 1,500 double agents. These double agents were then arrested. Some of them were even more than arrested. And you have this called honor. Honor, you know, this eervraak, it's called in Dutch. It's revenge, honor revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Their family is still wanting to avenge the arrest or the maltreatment of their family that were, you know, that were disclosed by him. And even though the Dutch government is saying, well, it's a completely different form of government, Slobodan says, The real rulers are still the secret agents. Nothing has really changed that much in Serbia, and that's why he's got a sword of Damocles hanging above his head, because he knows that if he gets deported, and which is what the Dutch government wants to do, in spite of a legal ruling prohibiting this, he fears for his life. So he's fighting this with tooth and nail, you know.
Okay, so Slobodan Mitric, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, and I'll ask that question then.
Are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I am delighted you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour, because you have missed a ton of information, but we're glad you're here now, and I think you will be too. My guest this evening is Robert Kelder. He is the publisher of a book called 9/11, The Accusation, written by Slobodan Mitric. Slobodan Mitric, former affiliation with the UDB, the Serbian Secret Intelligence Service. And, for those in the West, that's their version of the KGB. So if you're familiar with KGB, UDB is the Serbian version of that. And he's written this book. It's been translated into English, and because Slobodan does not speak English, His publisher is speaking for him tonight, and we're pleased to have him represent the book and make it possible for us to ask some questions about it. And I started to ask as we went to break, Slobodan Mitrovic fears for his life if he returns to Serbia because family members would of people that he exposed as double agents would want to seek revenge on him. That is reasonable. That, when I say reasonable, I mean that fits with what does go on in that part of the world. Revenge killings are not uncommon whatsoever.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, in Albania, it's called a blood killing and or blood feud. And these things go on for generations.
Yep.
You know, your great-grandfather hit my great-grandfather, so our grandfathers had to go at it. And then because they went at it, we have to go at it. And it just escalates and escalates. And it's so bad, they have a commission in Albania to try and settle blood feuds, to try and bring that under control, because it's just rampant. But Albania, of course, is not Serbia, but it's right next to it. It borders Serbia, and in that part of the world, that is a common thing. All right, so now let me ask you a question. What does Slobodan Mitrovic think was the reason for 9/11? You see, if it was Al-Qaeda, we have been provided the reasons by the media. The reasons, the basic reason is Islamic Jihad. Okay, so what's the reason if it's not Al-Qaeda, if it's this group of rich, powerful people that did this, why?
Well, there is one American critic, a writer, who has come up with this theory that 9/11 was a attempt to start a third world war, and that's Webster Tarpley in his false flag terrorism book, you know.
Okay, but what does Slobodan Mitrovic think?
Yeah, but that's exactly what Slobodan Mitrovic says in his book, Operation Twins One. He says that it was an attempt to start a third world war, which was averted at the last minute. But these and now you ask me, well, what is the motivation for these people wanting to start a third world war?
Right.
That is not does not become clear in the book. The book is not a psychological motivational insight into the driving force of the perpetrators. It's more a practical, graphic description of the actions of the people who did this, to a certain extent, a disclosure.
Mm-hmm. And he names these people, right?
Well, he names. I'll mention one. He mentions there's a chapter called Computer Programmer, right?
All right.
It's a story of a computer programmer from San Francisco who bought in the 90s for 5 million guilders a stately house in the Canal Street in Amsterdam. Now, this computer programmer sold software and developed software for the United States Army. But he also sold it to the Russians. And he sold it to this third party, which were actually behind 9/11, headed by this alias, this terribly powerful man named the Hague Mouse. But Slobodan then comments, actually, this computer programmer was a front for the GRU, the G-U-R.
Yes.
G-R-U, you know?
Yeah.
Which is not the KGB, but an even more secret Russian security service.
Yeah, look, for our American listeners, let me explain. It's
you
like
heard about this GRU, right?
Yes, for the American listeners, let me explain. Here in America, we have the CIA, but there's an even more secret agency called the NSA. Okay, so in Russia, they have the KGB, and we've all heard about them, but they also have the GRU.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so...
This software was actually developed by the GRU, and the Slobodan doesn't mention the name of this person who rented or bought this house, but the records show that it was Chris Dawes, the founder of Micromuse, a computer company in San Francisco, which got very rich by, as I said, developing software for the American Army. But it turns out that this Christopher Dawes had been, and this is like a double dealing. That's why I said it's a double dealing. It's very complicated. The book requires a very, very close study, and it's actually my aim is to arouse an interest in this book and start a discussion on it. This Chris Dawes was actually someone that was put in the place of a Australian guy who was killed by the Russians. They inserted him. They took his identity and paraded him as Chris Dawes. Now this because
okay. Now you're saying he's not really. Are you saying
also this
Robert? Are you saying that's not his real name?
Very intricate software to this third party headed
Robert,
by,
can you hear me?
By,
Robert, can you hear me? Robert.
The Hague Mouse.
Robert, can you hear me?
Planes.
All right. Robert, I've turned off your audio so you can listen, because I need to know the answer to this question, and I hope you can hear me, okay? The question is, are you saying that this Chris Dawes... That's not his real name? Is that what you're saying?
The planes were shot down by jet fighters. I'm paraphrasing what's in the book.
Robert, can you hear me?
One of the operators, a guy named Jill, and all these guys that parachuted out of the planes after they connected the computer to the steering system, have all German-sounding names, and so the gang. That's headed by the Hague Mouse is also given a name, Titans. It's a group consisting of neo-Nazis, radical anarchists, and Islamists. But he says that there's no blame to the so-called Arab hijackers. They were not to blame. But after two of these planes were shot down, one of these perpetrators by the name of Jill calls the Hague Mouse, and the Hague Mouse says, now we're going to direct I think he calls it a firefly, to the spider's nest, and that's an alias for the Pentagon. What they then do is then with the software that they got from this double dealing a computer program, they fired a rocket from a U.S. aircraft carrier, George Washington, to Cuba, redirected its route with the software that they had, and it was actually that rocket that hit the Pentagon, of all things. This is an incredible sounding, fantastic sounding explanation,
okay.
But to me, it's the only... It's the only explanation wait a second, there's somebody coming in here. I'm on the phone.
He can't hear you.
He can't hear me.
He can't hear you.
Okay, Robert.
No, if you're saying that Chris Dawes is not Chris Dawes.
Right,
okay.
Yeah.
So answer that question. Tell me Robert came down.
Okay.
I appreciate him coming in. A long time ago, I asked that over and over and over, and you weren't hearing me.
What was your question?
The question is, are you saying Chris Dawes is not Chris Dawes?
He is the computer programmer. His name is Chris Dawes, right?
Okay, but you said they inserted him in as Chris Dawes.
Yeah, right.
So who is he really?
It's a double. It's a double.
Who is he really?
He's a Russian double agent.
You're sure about this?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, but I always could hear you. You can't hear me.
Sorry?
See, that's my point. I always could hear you, but you can't hear me. What I'm asking you is, are you sure about the fact that this Chris Dawes is a GRU agent?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a bit of a mix-up here. You hear me? Do you hear me now?
Okay, I can hear you. Whatever's happening, you can't hear me. So we're going to turn your audio off for a minute and let you fix your phone. All right. If this is the case, ladies and gentlemen, do you understand how important this is? Now, I'm not saying that this is the case. I have questions about this. But if this is the case, that Chris Dawes is really involved in this, and if Chris Dawes is a GRU agent, that means you had involvement of the Russian government, or at least of the Russian GRU, in 9/11. That's pretty doggone serious. Okay, let's see if Mr. Kelder can hear us now. Robert, can you hear me now?
I can hear you fine, Kevin.
Okay.
You got to be very careful with this, because it's a very intricate state of affairs here. The GRU, it was not Chris Dawes who developed this software, but the GRU did that.
Okay.
But what he did is he also sold this software to the Russians and to this third party, which then was a reason for the FBI to start investigating his identity, and that's the reason why he fled from the United States, from San Francisco. He said he got involved with the Jewish mafia that got him on cocaine, and then he he bought a house in Amsterdam to kind of go underground. The involvement with it is not that the Russians were involved in directly in 9/11, but through this agent that kind of got sacked or got involved with other forces. They have an involvement. That's true, but it's not you cannot really blame them directly. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Okay, yeah. This Chris Dawes then was sort of one of their agents gone bad.
Sorry?
Can you hear me? I tell you what, let's hang up, and we will call you back. You could hear me fine during the first hour. For some reason, you can't hear me now, so we'll hang up the telephone.
I can hear you now again. I can hear you.
Okay, I don't want to spend the whole second hour saying, can you hear me? So we're going to hang up, and I'll call you back.
Okay.
All right. Well, I don't know. What do you think? Let's see if we can get him back online. Well, that didn't work, so we will try it again, and we will see if we can get our guest back. This is pretty serious stuff here. You see why I decided that I would do this?
Hello?
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Chris Dawes. You're saying that this was not direct involvement by the Russian government, but this was one of their agents kind of gone bad that did this.
Yeah.
Okay. And is he living in Amsterdam now?
No.
No, he died under mysterious circumstances in 1999 when this very fast car collided and completely burned. They found nothing to none of his remains. We suspected it was no ordinary accident.
Yeah.
You see, and this is one of the very very technically advanced. Things that are involved in this whole intricate operation. The other one is a telephone device that a Dutch engineer named Ferdy Elzas developed, which can simulate any voice. And that device was used by it was bought just as this. The Hague Mouse bought this software from the Englishman. He's called the Englishman in parentheses. The Hague Mouse also bought this telephone device from this Dutch engineer, with which he simulated the voice of the president of Russia. And in fact, Jill, one of the perpetrators, calls Cheney in the command center in the bunker, thinking it was President Bush, and feigns the voice of the President of Russia, and after that there is a commotion in the bunker a few days later, with Bush saying, "How come I didn't know about this invention of a telephone device that can simulate my voice? I'm the president, aren't I?" And the Secretary of Defense says, yes, you're the president, but only on paper. And then they're trying to figure out how to explain the fact that a rocket from the U.S. aircraft carrier George Washington fired a rocket into the Pentagon, killing some counterintelligence staff. And then I'm quoting the chapter, right, the chapter which is called... In the book that we're discussing, 9/11, the accusation, the chapter called "Bin Laden is a terrorist or the terrorist behind 9/11." There's a stocky, bald gentleman, who is not named by name, but Slobodan has showed a picture of him, and this is Kissinger. Kissinger spreads some documents on the table and says, "Gentlemen, you read this document." And then he directs himself to Bush Senior, Jr. and says, "You're going to announce to the Senate that behind this whole terrorist attack is Bin Laden." And Bush stutters and says, "Well, what? No, nobody will believe this." He says, "Are you crazy?" "No," he says, "you do what I say. If you do it all right, people will believe you." And that's the point in time that Bush is directed by Kissinger to shift the blame on this rocket attack and the whole thing to Bin Laden.
Okay, now here's the problem.
I agree.
Okay, Robert, listen. Robert.
Graphic, you know.
Robert.
Beating around the bush, so to speak.
Robert, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, listen. The problem with this is, and it may exactly be true, but the problem is, this is very detailed information about very high level, very secret meetings. How did Slobodan Mitric get the information? Did he have the room bugged? Does he have an agent inside that was in that room? How does he know about this conversation?
Many of these events are filmed. And I think he saw films of them. Everything that the Hague Mouse did was also filmed. Many of these pornographic pedophile scenes that are described, in which young girls are abducted and killed, these are also filmed. And I suspect that that either he saw a film, or he had witnesses from these events. It's something he hasn't told me exactly what his source are or how he got this detailed information, but he says I'm submitting this as evidence for people to investigate. And in fact, this is the whole point of this whole exercise, mm-hmm. is to start legal proceedings. This accusation must lead to an indictment.
Who does he think should be
in America who are considering or even have started proceedings, and they're looking for evidence. Well, this is a beginning for evidence. If you want, and this is, he said, if you want the whole story, I'm willing to give more evidence. I'm willing to give a picture. I'm willing to give a name of the Hague Mouse, but then I have to really protect myself for that. And that it's also a question of means, you know?
Okay. It here in the United States, it is not a shocker to us to hear that the president is being told that, yeah, you're just the president on paper. You don't really run anything.
We
sort of have figured out that somebody out there, somebody else, is running the presidents, because it doesn't matter whether you go Democrat or Republican, you wind up with the same pile of poop.
Yeah.
Either way, it goes the same way.
All right.
So that's not surprising to us.
No.
But what is surprising is details of the conversation between Kissinger and the president in very private, which would have been also very high level, very highly secret meeting.
Yeah.
And the question then is, okay, so how does Slobodan Mitrich come across this information, and how does he know that this information is true? As an intelligence, a former intelligence officer, I know that you get all kinds of bits and pieces of information. And there's a grading system whereby you grade the reliability. And it's a actual numeric system where you grade the reliability of the information.
Well,
and
I think that,
how would he have come by this? I mean,
he hasn't told me this, but what I know from his modus operandi is in his circle of friends, He has referred to General Healy as a member of the latent government, as someone who had direct contact with President Reagan, and he must have also had direct contact with Bush, and he may have actually been present at this meeting in this anti-nuclear bunker deep beneath the White House, in this chapter that I mentioned. It could very well be General Healy who's the source of this information.
Well, certainly
at that time.
Yeah, certainly if Healy was present, then we could have that. Yeah. All right. We're going to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Robert Kelder. He is a publisher from the Netherlands who is here representing some of the books published by his company, and one of those books, 9/11, The Accusation. Robert, when we had to step away for break, we were talking about the possibility that this Raymond Healy, referred to by Slobodan Mitrich as General Raymond Healy, if he in fact was a general, and if in fact he was everything that Mr. Mitrich represents in his book, then it is entirely possible that he could have been present at this meeting. Now, would you say that this General Healy I assume you've had conversations with Slobodan Mitrić about General Healy. Would you say that General Healy would be somewhat of a activist, but having wearing a uniform and wearing the general stars, but still somewhat of an activist, and that's why he was willing to disclose this outside of official channels?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Where is General Healy these days?
He's dead.
Do you know when he died?
No, not exactly. But he's been dead a few years. He had trouble walking, and I think one of his legs was amputated. But I'm fairly certain he was still alive 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering if that is perhaps the reason, if maybe his death was the reason the organization, Reserve Police Office, Reserve Police International, maybe that's why they stopped doing annual reports, because perhaps Healy died.
Yeah. No, it's not because he died. I don't exactly know what the reason was for disbanding it. If you look at the list of leaders that are, and I mentioned this magazine, The Globe, you know, that Healy published in Tucson in 1982. You find a lot of very extreme right-wing figures. Perhaps he became disillusioned with the power of this latent government that he saw operating behind the scenes, and that may have been a reason for him to confide this to Slobodan, hoping that Slobodan would make this known to the world. But again, this is something Slobodan has to answer.
How did Slobodan originally meet Raymond Healy?
I think that Raymond Healy was in Serbia during the Second World War, and they may have met there. He didn't really explain to me or ever told me how he met him. I know that Slobodan is writing his memoirs. Probably he will go into that, because he became a very important figure. I mean, he became his foster father. You know,
mm-hmm.
he became a sort of a son. He was destined to succeed Raymond Healy as world director of Reserve Police International. But the details I can't tell you.
Okay, so, as I understand it, 9/11, the accusation, presents this person, the Hague Mouse, as sort of the head of this international group of people that planned and executed the attacks that we refer to as 9/11. If we were talking Al-Qaeda, then we could say, okay, well, they did the attacks because they believe in Islamic Jihad. Why would this Dutch guy want to do these attacks and bring about this Third World War?
Why? Well, I mentioned there a gang, the gang operating is a gang consisting of these three factors, right? The groups, neo-Nazis, radical anarchists, and Islamists. Now, I don't know if you know this, but do you know who the first one was who ever thought of striking, hitting New York with aircraft?
No.
with Hitler.
Mm.
Hitler was actually developing at the end of the Second World War bombers that had enough of a capacity to reach New York, which he then thought they could, you know, they could instead of these V2s that he hit England with, he wanted to use them to strike New York. So that makes sense from a neo-Nazi point of view. I know also one of these operations that they killed a West German attorney general in Karlsruhe in the 70s. They called that Operation Revenge, and that gives a motive, a revenge for having lost the Second World War and acting revenge on the so-called victors. You know.
Okay,
that's what I can come up with.
So we have this group of really rich people who basically are anarchists. Is that right?
Radical anarchists, yeah.
You know, during the 70s and early 80s, we used to hear about the Bader-Meinhof terrorist group in Germany. And I think his name was Adrian Bader.
Yeah, right.
And if I may not be remembering this correctly, but wasn't he a rich guy? Wasn't he from a rich family?
Well, middle class family, the Bader-Meinhof gang, they're called.
Yeah. You know?
The RAF, the Rote Armee Fraktion, the Red Army faction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were really that rich. And in fact, they may have been in a sort. They may have been coaxed into. There's some books on this. I'm not an expert on it, but they may have been a front for something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with these gladiators. There's a chapter also in the book called "The Modern Gladiators," in which. This the same team that jumped out of the aircraft after robbing the passengers in the case of Lockerbie. In the case of Lockerbie, actually, there's a chapter devoted to it, in which it's called the chapter is called "Aircraft Fall from the Sky Like Raindrops." That's chapter 4, and it starts with a letter from the head of another organization which you won't find at all on the internet, and that's called World Atomic Counterespionage. It was an organization also founded by Healy in Tucson, and it's a letter written by the European director, and that is Mitrich. You know, he doesn't say it's him, but it's the director of Wacker, to the head of the CIA. I think it was 1992, but I may be wrong. Saying there's an Pan Am leaving Heathrow Airport in London with a gang of terrorist brigade named Titans. You know who they are. Please arrest them. Don't let them get on the plane. Now, the letter is not a facsimile. It's written in normal typewriter, normal text. Then there is a reply by the CIA director. I think it's, I forget the name, but it was Bill Webster, I think, to the effect, mind your own business. So, again, you have a forewarning by Mitrich of a impending aircraft explosion, which is not acted upon. And then the second half of this chapter shows Jill and his cohorts entering the plane robbing the passengers and then jumping out of the aircraft and landing somewhere near Manchester and walking or proceeding with a jeep onto a harbor in which some of his cohorts are waiting for him. And so this is another piece of very exact, detailed information, and the only thing that's lacking there is that he hasn't produced, by the author, the actual letter, you know. It would be a great thing if he could, in the documents, come up with his letter and the answer by the CIA director. But in the documents, there's in the appendices, there are some documents on the Lockerbie case. Meaning in effect that Gaddafi had nothing to do with it, the Libyans.
Well, if you had Islamists involved, you may have an indirect link, just as you have an indirect link to Russia through the GRU. So, I mean, if you have Islamists involved, you could have an indirect link to Gaddafi, just as you have an indirect link to Putin.
Yeah, but that's a speculation. I don't know of any information in the book which underscores that, you know. I'm only trying to argue very rigorously out of the arguments of the book and not inserting any possibilities. As far as I know, this chapter 4, aircraft fall from the sky like diamonds, there are absolutely no references to any Islamic or Libyan involvement.
Well, you told us, Robert, you told us just a few moments ago that this group of international rich people was made up of neo-Nazis, anarchists, and Islamists.
Yeah. Well, there is one character named Avdo. He's an Islamist. There may have been some members of this gang that have, because there's always been a very close connection, you probably know this from history, between the Nazis and the Islamists. You know, there was this Mufti that got very close to Hitler, and in fact there was a whole Islamic division fighting for the Nazis. So in that sense, there may be, you may be right, there may be an individual component relating to the Islamists.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. That means, of course, that we only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. And we are talking this evening with Mr. Robert Kelder. And he is the publisher of a book called 9/11, The Accusation, written by a former Serbian UDB agent, counterintelligence person, and this has to do with it's his take on the events of 9/11. The author, Slobodan Mitrić, does not speak English and so is represented by his publisher in English speaking interviews and for English speaking audiences. Now, Robert, got a really important question for you.
Okay.
And this isn't about you, about Mitrić, it's about you. You're
okay.
A publisher, and obviously, whenever you publish something, you have to weigh all kinds of considerations about whether you're going to publish a book or not. Why did you decide to publish this book? And let me add to that. You had to know it's going to be very controversial. You had to know that there were going to be a lot of tough questions and scrutiny. What is it that made you make the decision that, yes, I'm going to publish this book? I know what's coming, but I'm going to publish the book. What is it?
Well, there are actually three factors. One is my long professional and friendly relationship with the author.
Mm-hmm.
Having known him as a reliable person, also supplemented by testimony, for example, of the highest sort. In one of his trials behind doors, a president of Amnesty International testified as to the credibility of him, and he said, "I've always had the impression, the conviction, that the information coming from Dmitrich is of a reliable nature." Now that's one aspect. The other aspect, in other words, is his professional credentials and my long-term friendship with him. The other is, of course, the his incredibly detailed description of the events, as I said, amounting not to a conspiracy theory but a conspiracy practice, and having come to the conclusion that this work of him is at least worth it to be investigated, to be put out on the market, and as a starting point for a discussion, as an essential contribution to the 9/11 whole truth movement, because as far as I know, there has been no person forewarning of 9/11 then after the fact writing an account of it. So this in my opinion was enough of a reason to put this on the market, knowing that we would have to face some tough questions. And as far as putting it on the market is concerned, may I just mention that the book is available in Europe and in the United Kingdom, but not yet in America as a paper book. But it's available as an e-book on Amazon in a Kindle edition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be very soon on the market here in America, in bookstores or in Amazon, etc.
Mm-hmm. As a paper and ink book.
As a p-book, right? They call it a paperback. Yeah.
Okay. If you knowing what you know now after publishing the book, and you've been representing it, and so you've had to field questions about it, if you had to do it again, would you still publish this book?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm standing 100% behind the book, and my great objective is to find the necessary sales figures. If we sell enough of this book, if we sell 50,000 copies or something like that, then the necessary funds can come in to write the complete disclosure. Not, in other words, the successor to the advanced edition, the full edition, in which he will not only supplement what I've been saying, give more information, but he will inform, describe how the perpetrators got into the planes in the first place. His description of these fateful flights is that they're in the plane coming out of the baggage department, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't show how they got into the plane. He doesn't show either yet how the buildings came down as far as the explosives are concerned. How were they planted there? Who did that? So there are gaps in some of these chapters, but enough detailed information but also for judicial, for lawyers, for politicians, to say, hey, wait a minute, this guy knows something. Then we got to find out who he is. Let him give him a forum to speak, and get the lowdown on this whole thing. And perhaps we're coming to an end. May I mention that I've become a member of the We Are Change group here in New York while I'm still here for a couple of weeks. And I'll be out there at their group meeting Saturday, June 4th at 3:30, with some banners in front of the entrance to the PATH station on Vesey Street in West Broadway, helping people get an introduction to the book, landing out flyers and getting into contact with New Yorkers, especially New Yorkers who are of course concerned about this issue. And and we hope, and this is my hope and my wish, that that on September 11th this year we can come out with this complete edition, you know.
Well, I hope you can. I hope you can. I have a personal favor to ask you now. I've got some friends in the Netherlands, very good friends.
Yeah.
Theo, Tinny, and Indy van Binsbergen.
Yeah.
Would you say in your language, hello from the Kevin Smith Show, and I hope you've enjoyed it?
Okay, yeah, sure. That's no problem. Hello from the Kevin Smith Show. Ik hoop dat jullie dat hebben genoten. So that's how you say this in Dutch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Listen, I appreciate it very much. It's been very interesting. And there's certainly a lot of stuff for us to think about here. Folks, it's called 9/11, The Accusation. It's written by Slobodan Mitric, Mitric. And you can get it as a Kindle book over at Amazon, but not yet as a paperback in the United States. But it is available, I believe, in the UK. I think that's what Robert told us. Now, Robert, if you will, just stay on the line with me for a couple of minutes. I have to bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show Starship in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's going to be a wrap for tonight. Remember, we're listener-supported, and if you don't, we can't be here. So either join our members area tonight, cost you 23 cents a day, $6.95 a month, or make a donation to help us continue. Believe me, we're not getting rich here, because almost all the rest of the world is saying what you're saying. Let somebody else do it. We need you to do it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.